Thank you. My name is Eric Peterson. I'm Senior Vice President here at CSIS. It's a great pleasure on behalf of CSIS to welcome you all here. We're delighted to have yet another visit from an esteemed delegation from Turkey, and we've been very grateful for our continuing contact with Turkey on a range of issues of mutual interest to our countries. We recently had a delegation, Bulent, was it a month and a half ago?
That was the first financial delegation.
Yes, so we're delighted to have the opportunity for renewed contact. CSIS is also very proud to have a project dedicated to Turkey, and we're very lucky to have our colleague Bulent Ali Riza doing work in this regard. So we thank him for all his good efforts there. My own involvement in Turkey is substantially more modest. I'm delighted to tell you that I had the opportunity to visit Turkey in November as part of an overall world water assessment that we're doing now, looking at how various countries are dealing with the very complex and very important issues involving water across the world. And, of course, this will resonate with you as an upper riparian on the Euphrates. We've been looking at the experiences of a number of countries, and we chose Turkey because this is such a critical factor in terms of your economic and energy future, your relationship with other key players in your region of the world. So we were very grateful to have the opportunity to visit with your DSI. We were there at the invitation of your Minister of Agriculture, and very grateful for the opportunity to think through some of these big issues with friends in Ankara and Istanbul. We hope to come back to be a part of your World Water Forum event in Istanbul in 2009, and we've been working with friends in the World Water Council to that end. But this work on water is only a part of the broader attention that we give here at CSIS, and thanks to Bulent and other colleagues, we cover a range of issues involving governance. I see that we have Jerry with us on governance. And we look at European issues from a regional standpoint and a range of other functional issues, including energy and demographics and others, that bring us together in terms of mutual interests. So, Bulent, with that by way of background, thank you again for your visit to CSIS, and we look forward to hearing your views.
Thanks, Eric. And let me open up the meeting, although I know there are other people on their way. This is the third of the Turkish parliamentary delegations visiting Washington, and the focus of the visit, in fact, the reason for the visit is the Armenian genocide resolution, which is on the congressional agenda. Clearly, this is something that visitors today will want to talk about, but, you know, given the whole range of issues on the U.S.-Turkish agenda, as I'm made clear in the invitation, I'm expecting other things to come up either in what they're going to say or in the Q&A. Very quickly, so that I will not eat into that time, let me introduce our three guests today. Ambassador Yakush is no stranger to CSIS. He's been here a number of times before. And I guess the one that we remember most is when you accompanied Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his delegation here in January 2002, prior to the elections, which eventually saw you as the first foreign minister of the current government. He is a retired diplomat. He served in Cairo and Riyadh, as well as in Vienna, I believe. Very much look forward to what you're going to be saying, and you are the first speaker. To your left is Ambassador Honoré Man from the Republican People's Party, also a very distinguished former diplomat. His last position in the Foreign Ministry was as Undersecretary of the Foreign Ministry.
After that, he was Turkish permanent representative to NATO.
Was that after that? In fact, I was going to work backwards, but okay, I stand corrected. But and among his foreign postings, of course, it was the one that that Ambassador Yakush mentioned, and we look forward to hearing you as well Ambassador Rahman. And to my right is the third member of the delegation, who just reminded me that almost 20 years ago, when he was doing his master's at Penn State, I had made a presentation. Mr. Jibiji, who is now MP from the Republican People's Party.
We made sure that the proportional representation is also reflected in the...
Of course, it's Shukri Elekta, who's not with us today, who came from the Republican People's Party. I beg your pardon, you're from the Justice and Development Party. And, you know that the spirit of comity among you will allow you to forgive this. But it's good to see you again after so long. Anyway, without further ado, I give the floor to Ambassador Yakush. After all three of our guests have spoken, we will proceed to such questions as you may have.
Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to express my gratitude to Bülent for having arranged this meeting. It has always been a pleasure for me to address the audience, distinguished audience of the CSIS. And I learn a lot from the questions that are asked and from the issues that are raised here. So I presume that this time will be the same, especially with the... cooperation and the participation of the two distinguished members of parliament from Turkey. Since we wish to have to devote more time to question and answer period, we would like to be as short as possible in the initial remarks stage. The title of today's meeting was proposed as U.S.-Turkey Agenda. U.S.-Turkey Agenda is always full. It is we have a very rich set of relations, and in the military area, and in political area, and the geostrategic area, and the international cooperation everywhere. If we start from the military relationship, defense industry cooperation is one dimension of it. We have a high-level defense group which meets regularly in both capitals and with very concrete subjects spoken and taken up there. And Turkey and the United States cooperate within the framework of global war on terrorism, because you may know that Turkey is the country perhaps who suffered the most from the terror. We lost, the terror costed loss of lives in Turkey 10 times more than 9/11. So this gives you an idea how terrorism is important for Turkey. And of course, this also raised the question brings to the agenda the question of the importance that we attribute to our fight against the PKK terrorism, where American cooperation is not up to the expectation of Turkish public opinion. We are cooperating very closely in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a place where we have sent soldiers. Now we have something like 900 soldiers there, and we took the leadership in the command of the leadership in Afghanistan international forces on two occasions. In Iraq, we are cooperating in several fields. One of them, the most important in our opinion, is Turkey's contribution to get certain parties in Iraq, or sectarian parties, or other parties involved in the political process. We started with Sunnis, which thought that at the beginning that they wouldn't participate in the political process. We invited them to Turkey in several groups. They visited our party, the government offices, opposition parties, and we advised them that keeping themselves outside the political process may cost to them something that they may regret in the past, because Shias excluded themselves from the political process in 1930s, and they were left out of this process for 70 years. And if the Sunnis do the same now, we told them that we don't know how many years we will be left out. I remember one remark which was made one of the members of delegation at that time. He said, there's a good saying in Iraq which says the Shias beat themselves with chains, the Kurds dream, and the Sunnis rule the country. Of course, I don't know to what extent this will be the same in the future, but we will see. So one of the areas of cooperation between Turkey and the United States in Iraq was Turkey's contribution to get certain groups in Iraq get involved in the political process. There is substantial concrete support brought by Turkey to Iraq in terms of fuel, refined oil is, crude oil is extracted in Iraq, but their refineries are not functioning sufficiently, so it is being refined in Turkey and brought back to Iraq. 25% of Iraqi requirement for oil is met by from Turkey, and we provide something like an average of 220 megawatt power to Iraq. And there are around 1,000 Turkish companies active in all parts of Iraq, but especially in the Kurdish area. So this may prepare a ground for you to ask questions between cooperation between northern Iraq and Turkey. So around 1,000 businessmen are already active there. As to the military cooperation again, 70 to 75% of U.S. forces cargo is transshipped through the southern Anatolian town of Incirlik, where United States has, I mean, there is a NATO basis, and Americans are using this basis to transship cargo to Iraq. And for supply of oil in the air mission, 3,800 sorties were made by the U.S. planes to supply oil for the missions in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Then we cooperate elsewhere, except apart from Iraq. In Lebanon, we are cooperating with the international community and with the Americans. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, and in the Black Sea area. There are other areas where there is close cooperation, but I would like to confine my remarks only to this so that we can expand further on it. These are the areas where we cooperate at present. Are there clouds also on Turkish-American relations? Clouds and perhaps a tornado coming. This time on the map it is from the north, but it may come from anywhere on perfect storm, perhaps, yes. We hope that we will be able to avoid it. Where there are potentials of tornado, it is now a cloud, but could it turn into tornado, we will see it. It is on the subject of PKK cooperation for fighting against PKK terrorist organization, one. The second one is Armenian, so-called Armenian genocide resolution, and Iraq, especially Kirkuk. In Iraq, apart from Kirkuk, we have no different position. I mean, PKK is, of course, another chapter, but apart from this, our cooperation in Iraq functions very well, with the exception of diverging interests and diverging concerns regarding the change or forced change in the demographic composition of the population of Kirkuk. These were the challenges. There are opportunities, but I will leave it to a later stage when the questions come. I would like to comment on PKK, perhaps with his usual eloquence. Ambassador Öymen will be able to talk better. On Armenian resolution, I would like to say only a few words. There is a resolution called Resolution 106, tabled in the House of Representatives, which invites Turkey to recognize the Armenian genocide and invites the president to reflect this in the foreign policy statements, etc. Where do we not agree with the United States on this, or with the initiative of some members of the House of Representatives? There is a misperception, most probably, in the mind of these initiators of this resolution as well, because there it says in the preambular part of the resolution, it said that Turkey denies that anything happened in 1915 in the Ottoman times, etc. We don't deny it, first of all. We know that the very unfortunate events took place in 1915. Massacres took place at that time. Turks massacred Armenians, and Armenian massacred Turks. What is missing there? There is only reference to the to the massacres committed by Turks, but there is no mention at all of the massacres committed by Armenians on Turks. This is one thing. So massacres, yes. Is it genocide? No. Genocide is something else. Genocide is defined in 1948 United Nations Convention on the Prevention and the Punishment of Genocide, where it says that for an event to be characterized as massacre, there should be a court decision. A court decision in the country where the massacres are claimed to have taken place, or by an international court. For instance, for what Hitler has done in the Second World War, it is a massacre because Nuremberg court genocide, because Nuremberg court decision says that it is a genocide. What Mladic has done in Bosnia-Herzegovina is genocide because the International Court of Justice decided that it is a genocide. Now, there is nothing of that sort for the massacres that has taken place in Ottoman Turkey in 1915. This is one thing. Of course, the intention to erase the entire race or part of that race from the earth, it has to be there for an act to be characterized as genocide. We do not accept that this has happened, because all the archive documents indicate that this decision was taken by the Ottoman authorities in a very difficult period, when Turkey was at war in three different fronts. One in Dardanelles with the Allied forces, second in the Suez Canal with the British forces, and in the Caucasus area in the eastern Turkey with the Russians. And at that time, the Armenians were stealing the ammunition and weapons from the storage room of the military of the Turkish army, and siding with Turkey's enemy, Russia. And the Ottoman authorities felt the obligation or need to relocate Armenians. And the number of the relocated people is supposed, according to the documents, to be around 700,000. And the number of those who arrived at their destination is more than 400,000 people. So something around 300,000 people may have perished during this relocation. Were they killed? They were killed. They died of hunger. They died of epidemics and all sorts of things. And most probably, there were also attacks on the convoys by the villagers who have been attacked in the past by the Armenians. So all sorts of unpleasant things have happened at that time. To what extent it is justified? When I say those who died, who perished, is around 300,000, even one single loss of life is too much. But this figure of around 300,000 is far below the figure which is mentioned by the Armenian diaspora to be 1.5 million. So this is where we are on the Armenian question. If you permit me, I will stop here, and I will perhaps turn to my colleagues whether they have anything to add to this or other subjects, and we may perhaps expand further when we go to the question and answer.
Clearly, we're all interested in the impact on the U.S.-Turkish relationship. That's something that Ambassador Iman and maybe Mr. JBG will pick up. But without further ado, I think... we only have one microphone. Can you move that one? That would be a good idea, actually.
All right.
That's my
Thank you very much indeed. So Mr. Yakish has very well summarized what happened. I would like to perhaps tell you a few relatively unknown parts of the story. The story is that this Armenian genocide allegations have a lot to do with the participation of United States to the First World War. At that time, as you know, the main concern of the British government was to persuade the American government to enter the war, and the American government administration was very reluctant. So the British Wellington House, that's to say War Propaganda Bureau, has invited 25 or so leading personalities, authors, writers, poets, and they said, look, you are going to write books, pamphlets against our enemies, that's to say Germany and Turkey, to such extent that those persons who will read these books will detest these countries. The main purpose was to mobilize American public and using the influence of American public over the administration to take a decision to participate to war. Finally, this group has written 1,156 books and pamphlets against Germany and Turkey, full of unrealistic, fabricated stories. For instance, for the Germans, they say that when the German armies entered Belgium, they cut the hands of all babies. They hanged all priests. So things like that. The purpose, again, was to persuade the American public. There was one telegraph cable between Germany and the United States at that time, enabling to communicate between Germans and the American press, so they cut this cable, the British. So the only communication was between the Wellington House and the American public through British ways. So finally, this played a role in persuading, in disseminating among American public these feelings, anti-Turkish, anti-German feelings, and then the public indeed forced the government to enter the war. This is the short story. So what happened afterwards? After the war, the British Foreign Minister Chamberlain came to the House of Commons and said that all this was a propaganda. And what we wrote about Germany was totally war propaganda material. And there was also books published in Britain by British parliamentarians explaining all the stories I told you. Ponsonby, for instance, a former British MP, wrote a book on that. And what we did 2 years ago in the Parliament, we wrote a letter to the House of Commons saying that it so happened for Germany. So the same happened for Turkey. Please go to the House of Commons and tell the people that it was also a propaganda publication, what is printed by the British Parliament at that time, or under the British Parliament's authority. The Blue Book was a propaganda material. So we got an answer saying that, well, it was a propaganda book, but we cannot say anything about the content. So it's where we are. That's to say, this Armenian allegations have something to do with the First World War and with the propaganda organization of Britain aiming at the United States. As regards today's situation, we believe that we are ready to talk about Armenian issues. And we need to talk about Armenian matters. To start with, what's happening today? Actually, for instance, after the occupation of Nagorno-Karabakh by Armenian troops, besides Nagorno-Karabakh, six provinces of Azerbaijan are actually under the occupation of Armenia. Altogether, 20% of the territories of Azerbaijan is occupied by Armenia, and there are 1,010,000 refugees. The Azeris lost 20,000 people in this conflict. And all international organizations, United Nations, Council of Europe, OEC, etc., all these organizations admit that these lands occupied by Armenia today belong to Azerbaijan. So we have to start with this. We have to discuss this as a matter of priority, because more than 1 million refugees have to return to their homelands. And number two, about Turkish-Armenian relations, we need to talk about that, because the main problem is that the Armenian government today do not recognize the actual borders between Turkey and Armenia. We have signed an agreement with Armenia on the 2nd of December 1920, 5 years after the events that Mr. Yakış has mentioned, an extremely cooperative and friendly agreement, and fixing the borders, and saying that Armenia decided to cancel all its international agreements aiming to damage Turkey's interest. Thirdly, Armenia agrees to withdraw all its propaganda teams sent abroad to blame Turkey. So a lot of articles in the treaty denounce what is defended today by some members of Armenian diaspora. I have the text. If you are interested, I can give you a copy of this agreement, but the Armenian government canceled this agreement afterwards, recently. The other problem is that those Armenian terrorists, they killed more than 40 Turkish diplomats. So most of the murderers are not known. Who killed our ambassador in Paris, Mr. Ismail Erez? Who killed our ambassador in Vienna, in Rome, in Athens, several other places in Belgrade, it's known and arrested. But most of the killers of Turkish ambassadors and diplomats are unknown. Where are they? Who is in charge of looking after this matter? So we are interested to talk about that. And we are also interested to talk about what happened in 1915. For instance, a recent book has been published by Professor Justin McCarthy saying that, if you don't have a copy, perhaps our embassy can provide you one. It is said, among others, that just in one province, one, during the Armenian Rebellion at that time, 62% of the entire Turkish population was killed, massacred by Armenians, which makes 194,000 people. So if you read the testimonies in the American Congress here by American officials, State Department, Department of Defense, others, you will find a lot of interesting information about the Armenian issue, with the exception of the massacre of Turks by Armenians. There's no word at all. According to our confirmed official figures, 508,000 Turks have been massacred by Armenians in the eastern provinces of Anatolia. Nobody knows about that, and nobody interested to know how many Turks were killed by Armenians. And so this is an issue that should be tackled with cooperative spirit. We are ready to face the challenge of the history. And we decided together with the government party in the parliament to make an appeal to the Armenian government to bring together the historians. They have to sit together, provide their documents, you know, open their archives, and tell us what happened exactly. So what could we do more than that? In Boston, the Armenian archives closed. In Yerevan, the Armenian archives closed for historians. So many Turkish historians applied without any chance to be able to study their archives. So we opened our archives, military archives, state archives, foreign ministry archives. At this moment, what we are expecting is to bring together the historians and to study all these files. This was our former proposals, unfortunately rejected by the Armenian government. We had an excellent relations with the previous Armenian government, previous President Ter Petrosyan. I spoke with him several times, and we brought him together with Aliyev, Haydar Aliyev, and we started a good dialogue between the two of them to find a solution to this Nagorno-Karabakh problem. But after Kocharyan came to power, unfortunately, we have not found the same interlocutors in Armenia. Otherwise, we have sent ambassadors from Turkey to Yerevan just to, in special missions. We have sent members of parliament. They send us some special representatives. I received many of them. And we started a real, genuine dialogue with Armenia during the time of Ter Petrosyan. And he was very much aware of the merits of good relations with Turkey. We are missing him today, to tell you the truth. As regards to Northern Iraq, just one or two words. You know, as regards to Iraq in general, we believe that we have common interests with the United States in bringing not only peace and stability, but also democracy to the area. The missing point is democracy. We believe that in case we can spread a real democracy to the Middle East, we will have an insurance policy against wars and confrontations. Because so far in the world, there was no war among democratic countries. So how to expand democracy? There is a key word to make these countries a real democracy, because so far the efforts spent in this direction failed to a large extent because this important point was missing. If you want to make a Muslim country a real democracy, you have to separate religion from the affairs of the state. If you don't do this, you won't have a democracy, full stop. In the Iraqi constitution, for instance, you study Iraqi constitution in Article 2, it is said that no law can be against the basic Muslim rules, which means that the project is not a real democracy project, it's not a secular project, it's an Islamic state project. Those two things are not compatible. For instance, in a Islamic country, you can't have gender equality. If you don't have gender equality, you don't have democracy. As simple as that. Therefore, what we suggest to our American friends, and they, I believe, receive with quite an interest, that to work together to expand a real Western-style democracy to the area, starting with Iraq. If not, what will happen? I'll tell you, and I'll finish with that. If not, unfortunately, you should know that some other countries will use religion for their own purposes. And they may be more successful than you. Sometimes you believe that your main enemy is radical Islam. To fight with radical Islam, you should find some allies among moderate Muslim countries. There is no such thing like moderate Muslim countries. All the radical Muslims today were previously moderate Muslims, starting with Iran. Therefore, don't try to use this way, you know, fighting with radical Islam, using moderate Islam. It's a non-starter. So this, I'll tell you that the end result will be the following. Iran may use the Shia influence in Iraq and expand its influence further in the Gulf area, using Shias in Kuwait, Shias in Saudi Arabia, Shias in Bahrain. 75% of the population of Bahrain is Shia. Then using Shia connection with Syrian government, with Hezbollah in Lebanon, so they will have a Shia belt between Iran and the Mediterranean. So it's an extremely dangerous game to play the religion as a tool in international politics, particularly in the Middle East. So our message is that we should better work together to export a real democracy, and Turkey may be used as a springboard of democracy to the region, because we are the only country who managed to have democracy, secularism at the same time in the last 80 years. While concluding, I would say that on PKK issue, unfortunately, we are so far unable to read the American policy, because we are supporting very strongly your policy against terrorism. I'm the person who said in NATO, the day of the 11th of September, that we are all Americans. And your ambassador told me that no other country supported us as much as you do, and as much as Turkey does. So what President Bush has said, he said that either you are with us or you are with terrorists. We have no gray area. It's exactly what we say now. Either you are with us or you are with terrorists. We don't have gray area either. So we cannot understand the American reluctance to combat terrorism in northern Iraq, and even more or even less, we don't understand why Americans want to prevent us from defending ourselves against this terrorist. So this is the only place in the world where terrorists enjoy of a safe haven. There is not a single place in the world where terrorists are unchecked by any security organization. We asked our American friends, who is in charge of PKK in northern Iraq? The answer is nobody. Could you imagine that? In a country where you have 150,000 American troops, nobody is in charge of, you know, neutralizing terrorists. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. We have spoken with our friends in the State Department and Department of Defense. We have not received any plausible answer to that.
Convincing.
They said, well, we care the stability in northern Iraq. We say, well, in that case, you don't care the stability in Turkey. Because if you cannot protect our border, then they pass through the border. They bring explosives to Turkey. We have actually more than 1 ton of C4 explosives carried by PKK into Turkey through this unprotected border. So then we arrested only a few days ago in Istanbul a suicide bomber with a huge amount of C4 explosives. You know, if the instability starts in Turkey as a result of these terrorist activities, who will pay the price? I don't believe that the Americans will be happy to help indirectly to create instability in Turkey just for the sake of stability in northern Iraq. It won't work. And the price of stability in northern Iraq should not be the appeasement of terrorists. As simple as that. So we are the best friends of Americans. We have worked with Americans for so many decades. We have solved together so many problems. Sometimes we disagreed with each other. But each time we understood each other. Even if we disagree, we understood each other. We solved together solutions to the problems. For the first time, we just don't understand American policy on PKK in northern Iraq. Full stop.
Thank you, Ambassador Ayman. And now, Mr. Cevici of the Justice and Development Party. And again, I apologize for...
That's perfect. All right. I thank you very much, Sir Lusa. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today, being over here is both a pleasure and honor for me. However, I have to be honest to myself that for unknown reasons, the level of adrenaline in Ankara is much higher than Washington, D.C. So if it was left to me, I would have picked a different week because it is really, for most of you know, in Ankara, what we have been going through in terms of elections. It is a much fun place in Ankara. Now, when we have such a distinguished audience, and unfortunately, when I have two really veteran diplomats and speakers before me, it is very difficult to say something that either they have not said or you have not heard. But I will try my best.
You cannot say the possible implications or effects of the passage of the...
Now, you understand my former minister is giving me some clues.
He's doing now, more than
when Americans, I thought... mentioned perfect storm, I thought before yesterday that was a matter of figurative speech. I was driving yesterday from New York, and it was really a perfect storm. I don't have a background on foreign policy. I have a background on academia and business. But having spent more than two-thirds of my adult life in this country and being a good student of American politics, I would like to say a few things. There are elections in Turkey this year, and friends, politics, for those of you who might have even the smallest interest to get into, is such an area that you have all the relationships and the friends until midnight 12. And then all the memories are erased, and the next day at 8 a.m., you have to start back gaining them back. This is almost a representative of the international relations between the countries. So we have done so many things together with our allies during the Cold War, but now it is a different world. Now let me move to a more serious note. The first, the Armenian resolution. A couple of points. It was probably originally, I don't know whose thought it was, but I think it is an American thought, that you cannot force change. You cannot impose change. And I spent half day of the official program, and I already have heard twice that we have to reconcile with our past. We have to go back and thought things differently. And I perfectly understand that. But that process needs time, and that process needs our work. If something, for most of you, I know you are either know Turks very well, and there are some Turks in this place. If the Turks are forced to accept something that they are not ready to accept, and I'm not talking the genocide, I'm talking something, some of the realities what has happened in 1915, it will backfire. It will tremendously backfire. And when I'm saying that, I have the best intentions to explain myself. Reconciliation, we understand. Look, what you have heard just a few minutes ago, a former Minister of Foreign Affairs said that the Turks committed atrocities, massacres. You didn't hear these words 20 years ago, even 15 years ago. So that is a progress. But now, a resolution passes in the House of Congress, believe me, this thing, whatever the reconciliation will happen, and I don't expect that the Turkish Republic or the Turks as a nation will ever accept anything in terms of genocide, because we truly believe that we have not, or they have not, done that. So something that we believe, unless something that was hidden somewhere in the last 92 years comes up, some historian brings up something that is not in the archives, because what is out right now does not constitute, it doesn't add up to genocide. Now, but again, the progress we have made by ourselves, this has to be considered. Now, we have a tremendous free ride problem over here. What is the free ride? We know the changes in the Congress and the leadership and how the Democratic Party sees what happens in the Congress and how it will be difficult for the current administration to reverse things. Why reverse things? Because believe it or not, I'm probably as a normal rationale as well as much as the next guy. But if this passes, that I'm forced by my constituency to react disproportionately. When I say react disproportionately, we are not leaving anything out of the table. Now, this is not a threat because we are friends and we would like to cooperate with the United States. It is the interest of both countries to do that. However, everybody has to understand that I have a constituency and I come from a relatively conservative part of the country, and I have to explain what I do, what I don't do to my constituency, as well as any politician from California or Michigan or Boston. Now, I need you to understand, I do not make the Turkish policy. I just, whatever is made as policy by my government, I go back and I market and sell that policy to the people who voted for me. And when I'm outside the country, then it's a different thing than I am representing the Turkish policy. But I need you to know, to understand that it is increasingly getting difficult to sell the policies because we have not left that much of a room in this thing. Final two, three words regarding PKK and the Northern Iraq. It should be understood that the PKK and Northern Iraq issue is the most serious security challenge that our republic have ever faced and probably will ever face for the next some years. And this has to be understood properly by everybody. Now, when Mr. Barzani says a sentence, and when I go back to a coffee house in my district, when they ask me, how come this guy is saying such and such, when he is basically using the American taxpayers' money, using the American weaponry, and relying on the American power, and Americans are our allies. Believe me, whatever the knowledge and information I have about the United States, there is no way you can answer that question, and you will be credible after that. Now, for those of you who know Turkish in this area, deniz hakikaten bitiyor arkadaşlar. So, these are the messages basically we would like to communicate.
Let me take a crack
at this. That wouldn't be translated properly, so I would not even try.
My right and to my left are both from the Black Sea region, and this is about a captain. And most jokes usually have the people of the Black Sea coast, the Laz, as the butt. And in this case, the captain runs the ship aground, and then they ask him what happened, and he said the sea came to an end. And so what the gentleman is saying, the sea has come to an end, literally translated. But what he means is that really this situation is very, very serious.
Please, the last thing is, now good friend Ambassador Oyman has said that it is getting difficult for us to read the American policy and what they are trying to achieve their objectives in Northern Iraq. Now, I'm a little bit more optimistic, but I know in my heart that at this point, maybe the policymakers in the United States do not know exactly how they want to deal with this problem. So I will give that much of the benefit of the doubt. But please, our situation is much different, and we need this understanding. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. I think we got about half an hour. We have to leave just before 4:00.
And my question relates to your context here. Now, you are at the State Department, I believe, today, and the administration is opposed to the resolution. Now, no doubt the administration has or will not will tell you that ultimately this is a decision that Congress will make. Now, you will remember, Ambassador Yakush, when you were foreign minister, you came here to meet with President Bush and others on Turkey's possible support for the United States in the Iraq War, and ultimately the Turkish Grand National Assembly voted against it. Now, bearing that in mind, please could you explain how you're going to deal with this administration Congress divide as you engage in your context here?
Thank you very much. Well, I'm very grateful for this question. If you were not going to ask such a question, I was going to pull a little bit to stretch another question to come to this subject.
Any way you want to tackle it.
Yes. If so far I did not come across with any American friend of mine who was able to explain to me the following. If this resolution passes, Turkish-American relations will be affected negatively, and in Cebeci's term, the sea will come to an end. Turkish-Armenian relations will suffer, will be affected negatively. Armenia is already excluded itself from several regional cooperation. If this passes, of course, reaction in Turkey will go even further up. So the passage of this resolution will do harm in all possible areas. No American friend of mine was able to tell me that, yes, American-Turkish relations will suffer, Turkish-Armenian relations will suffer, Armenia will suffer, but in exchange of this, we are going to obtain this benefit. There is no benefit. When you pass this resolution, what the Americans are going to win, to earn, are they going to capitalize on it? This is unclear. Whereas in the example that you gave, that's to say when the Turkish government tabled a resolution, a motion, it did not go through because at that time the parliamentarians thought that if Turkey enters the war, it will suffer negatively. So if a member of the, a congressman or member of House tell me what we, at that time it was your parliament's decision, you suffered the consequence of it, this time it will be our parliament's decision and we will suffer, you will suffer the consequences. If there is a parallel like this, what I do not agree with is, in the question regarding the 106, Resolution 106 on Armenian genocide, there is no beneficiary on the American side which could explain, which could justify the entire exercise. Whereas there was a legitimate concern that I shared with the president. I told him that now it is very inappropriate time because the parliamentarians were coming back from a religious holiday at that time and they felt the pulse of their constituents and the majority of the Turkish population is against American intervention in Iraq to begin with. So when the members of parliament come from their constituents with such fresh impressions, they were inclined to vote against. And if you remember the subtlety under which the voting has taken place, those who said, yes, American troops should be allowed to pass Turkish territory was 262. Those who said yes, who said no, they should not pass, it was 252. But since the majority required by the Turkish legislation the quorum required for that was not achieved, so the motion was rejected. So the circumstances are not comparable.
Could I, now, again, without drawing any kind of analogy between the two votes, what I want to, and forgive me for pressing the point, and maybe Ambassador Rahman, I want to jump in. See, the argument that was made, like I said, I'm not drawing an analogy, after the vote in the Turkish parliament was, by the Turkish government, was, look, we made a good effort to get this through. It did not work. The U.S.-Turkish relationship is important. In this case, what we will have, if it passes, is the administration saying we opposed it. Now, Mr. Cebeci, you talked about a disproportionate response. Will you have any difficulties as the government, or will you have any difficulties as the Turkish parliament in deciding how to respond, given the fact that the administration will have opposed what is congressional action?
We may have different comments on this. Shall we ask first Öymen to say it and later me?
Before you answer, what I will then go to Mr. Larrabee, and given the fact that all three of you are members of the Turkish Grand National Assembly, and today is the first day of the presidential process, there may be some people in the audience who may wish to touch on that or any other issue that now that we have these three distinguished guests. Ambassador Öymen.
Well, thank you very much. What was missing, I believe, in our way of explaining to Americans at that time. I understand that it was a new government in Turkey. Besides, except my good friend Mr. Yakış, there was not a big experience in the government on such niceties. We had to tell the Americans that according to our constitution, it would not just be possible to pass such a resolution, because our constitution says that the parliament can decide to send troops abroad or to invite troops from outside, and also this is conditional. What's the condition? Condition is international legitimacy. As long as there is no international legitimacy, like a clear decision of United Nations Security Council, even the parliament is not authorized to authorize the government. You see, it was a very clear thing. When we explained this to our American friends afterwards, they understood. But it should have been explained before the voting. And therefore, it should not have been presented to the parliament, such an amendment, first. Second, I wish you read the proposal of the government to the parliament. If you would be surprised, but if you read the text, you will not find one single reference to Iraq. Could you imagine that? American troops will enter to Turkey, 65,000 troops, 250 aircraft, to be sent to neighboring countries. Which neighboring country? It's not written. For how long they are going to stay in Turkey? It's not written. Nobody knows. You see? How many troops will go and how many troops will stay? It's not written. Such an obscure and imperfect proposal to the parliament. No parliament can authorize a government on anything like that. So those are basic things that led so many parliamentarians, including 99 members of parliament from the government party, to vote against.
What about the response to a possible Armenian resolution? How would that be?
Well, the Armenian resolution is something totally different. So in this case, we had constitutional reasons to vote this way. But there is no constitutional obligation from United States to vote such an Armenian resolution. So who forced American congressmen or senators to vote such a resolution? Why? Because according to international law, in 1948 International Convention on Fighting Genocide, there should be a courtish decision to talk about genocide. You cannot decide as a political body, a parliament or a government, you cannot say that there was a genocide here or there, because you need to have a court decision, competent international court decision. As long as you don't have such a decision, you cannot talk about genocide, as simple as that. So there's no legal ground in this, in the case of parliament decisions on genocide. So we mentioned this to some European countries where they passed from their parliament such resolutions. Those are not based on legal decisions of any court. As simple as that. Read the text of the International Convention Combating Genocide. You will find precisely these words. Read Article 4, read Article 6. So this is a simple fact. As long as there is no court decision, no parliament or no government can claim that there was a genocide here or genocide there. Why there was no parliament decisions on Srebrenica and they went to the court? So there is a court decision today and everybody knows what the court decided. Why you have not decided whether what happened in Srebrenica in Bosnia was a genocide or not in the Congress? You see? So this issue of genocide is a very sensitive issue, and without having a court decision, I don't believe that it's not up to any parliament, any Congress, to decide that there was a genocide, there was not a genocide. It's not up to the politicians to decide.
Thank you. Steve,
well, actually, my comment was going to be very short. The government, even if the government doesn't do anything, we are talking of the parliament also. The facilities and concessions that we are extending to America to benefit, to utilize facilities in Turkey, will have to be renewed from time to time. It will have to come to the parliament. And, of course, every parliamentarian will be affected, or his position will be determined, as Mr. Cebeci said, by his constituency. If the constituents say that after America has done this, will you vote in favor of the extension of the permission of Americans to do this and that, then the member of parliament will have to answer this question. So even if the government doesn't take a concrete measure, there is also a parliamentary dimension to it, and also another dimension, such as evaluation of the tenders, international tenders for defense cooperation. Now there is a project called Nabucco project to carry gas from Turkey through Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, and to Austria. Gaz de France, the French gas company, wanted to participate in this. A Turkish company which is there, which has the right to vote against it, BOTAŞ, said, no, I don't want France, Gaz de France, because they are tabling a motion on Armenians on the French parliament. This is the decision of a company, not of the government. So this type of reactions have also to be taken into consideration.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for waiting.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. I would treat the first part, if I may, as a comment. And to save time, could you possibly address the question rather than the comment, please?
Regarding the first question.
Well, the first was a comment. And to save time, frankly, you know, take it as a friendly suggestion, as a comment, but okay, treat the second, second, if possible.
Turkey, party position on the statement of Erdogan, you don't expect me to reject the statement made by my party chairman, because actually at the source of it, it was a suggestion made by me. It is an evolution of this suggestion, actually, because when we were establishing the party, I was asked to draft the chapter of the party program regarding the foreign relations. I was deputy chairman of the party in charge of international relations. When I drafted this, I talked to Gül at that time, and I said that there are things that we could do in Iraq. There are developments in Iraq which will be beyond our control. So let's make a distinction between the two, and let's not make statement at this stage, when we were at the opposition at that time, which will commit us, and it will be difficult to disengage ourselves from this when we come to power. So we know at least what we cannot control in Iraq. And we know how we can establish good relations, because Americans will not stay there forever. Sooner or later, they will leave the region one way or another. Kurds and Turks will remain there. So we should be focusing our attention to this distant future and try to elaborate, shape our policy according to this distant target. And Gül said at the time, yes, you are very right, but can we turn this bent so easily now that we are driving so fast? Because the events were developing very fast. So this is what I can offer as comment at this stage regarding your question.
I'm actually going to exercise chairman's prerogative straight to Carol McDonald's, because no, we're running short of time.
The resolutions in Congress now are considered sense of Congress resolutions. They convey a thought. They have no legislative binding effect on the executive branch of government in the United States. They don't have any criminal consequences for people who say there was no genocide, i.e. sort of like what France or Germany are thinking about doing. And it seems to me that, yes, Turkey can and should react if it disagrees with these resolutions, but why react disproportionately? It does seem to me that there's an element of common sense missing somewhat in respect to the reaction. Several weeks ago, the Washington Post had an op-ed column by Jackson Dial in which he advised Turkey to react with a shrug. Well, I think that maybe Turkey would be justified in reacting with more than a shrug, but it does seem to me that some of the suggestions that you are making for reaction are really disproportionate to the nature of the resolution.
Okay, I'm going to go to Mr. Jebeci on this one, and then maybe Mr. Ambassador Raymond will
Thank you very much. I perfectly understand the point made, and the short answer is this, because when your mouth is really burned because you drink hot milk, then you will eat the yogurt with really caution. That is an old Turkish proverb. But the reason is this. Actually, the answer is inside this HR 106 in the preamble, because what they do, they pick and choose the former things that have passed in the Congress that were not, they were not resolutions, and they mentioned those things, but they were very selective. If you, for those of you who read that, you will see, so that if Here is the fear. If everything else was perfect or right in our relationships with the United States, and this was the only issue, maybe we would not have reacted the way we are right now. But when there are a lot of blurry areas, you see, my constituency asks my question, how come the United States prefer or choose, such and such in the northern Iraq over a 73 million country. So when there are all those blurry areas, it is very difficult to be the way you are describing that we should be or we could be. So very shortly, if you allow me, two things about the previous things. Number one is the March 1st resolution, why it not your question. Now, if anybody asks that question to me, I tell them how much time you have. Because I could tell the story for 3 days.
You've got about 8-9 minutes.
I know. And that is very difficult because in that voting, you have so many different factors that came together and made that American perfect storm. In that perfect storm would be something really little. So that is why you cannot make a one-to-one analogy with that one and what it passes with. In the Armenian resolution. And also, the Turkish government at that time did not behave in such a way that, okay, this is the parliament's decision, we cannot influence, and we will leave it to the parliament. It was after that the government came out and said, we are sorry, we have done our best, but that is what we could do. So, and the same thing could be done by Americans. We are adult people. We don't have to avoid these things. We should talk. And if this resolution passes, believe me, the sun will come out from east the next day also, and we will be there, and America will be here. But who will benefit out of this thing? And really, as Mr. Minister has said, you have to compare, or people who will vote, and I know it is a domestic politics issue. I know it is not, a majority, 90% of them do not really know the real content, the motives and all those things. It is just the pressure from the donors and the constituencies. They vote one way. But still with that, I think the relationship between Turkey and the United States is in such a level that the administration would be careful enough not to let this thing pass. Thank
Again,
you.
You know what, with your permission, I will give you the next answer and go straight to the gentleman in the back. Could you please identify yourself?
First of all, about the first question on the Armenian resolution, precisely our people is not very much interested with the juristical nature of the resolution, whether it's a sense of Congress or it's a clear-cut decision of the Congress. What is more important precisely for our people is the sense of Congress. If the congressmen feel that the Turkish people, our ancestors, committed a genocide, This will create an extremely big disappointment in Turkey, which will affect undoubtedly the Turkish government. And as Mr. Yakış and Mr. Cebeci have said, it will have an impact on our relations, unfortunately. You know, it happened once. We have a bad example in our past. In 1975, the American Congress decided an arms embargo against Turkey on Cyprus. The administration was again against. And we worked together with the administration. But the immediate result was that the Turkish government at that time, who was a conservative government, very close to the United States, the following day, they decided to stop the American use of Turkish military installations. It lasted 3.5 years. It was an extremely bad period for Turkish-American relations. Finally, the Congress canceled this decision and we normalized our relations. But it was a totally unnecessary resolution. You know, we have such experiences in our past. As regards to autonomous Kurdistan or Muslim democracy, I believe that on such issues we have to be very honest with each other. First of all, if you believe that according to realpolitik, Iran should be divided, then this will be the end of the Iraq. This will be the end of the story. Imagine that today 60% of the Iraqi population is Shia. If you divide into three, in the south oil-rich region next to Persian Gulf, there will be a Shia state with 95% Shias. Could you imagine the Iranian influence over this government and over through this government over the Gulf countries? It will be a disaster. We are not thinking only in terms of Kurdistan. We are thinking in terms of Iraq in general. So your principal policy was to keep Iraq intact as a unitary state, as a single state. It's exactly our policy. We don't see any reason to deviate from this basic policy. As regards to Muslim democracy, there is no such a thing like Muslim democracy. So much so that, for instance, in Germany, in France, in European countries, you may have Christian democratic parties, whereas in Turkey you cannot have a Muslim democratic party. It's prohibited by our constitution. It is so sensitive that in Turkey we separated the religion from the affairs of the state. As I told you, Thomas Jefferson has said once that we erected a wall between the state and the religion. It's exactly what we did in the early 20s. So if you dilute now secular democracy in Turkey, if you add a religious element into our policy, then the end result will be a total destruction of democracy. There is no democracy in a Muslim country without secularism. That's why Turkey is the only democracy among 54 Islamic nations. 57. There was one exception. Bangladesh was created as a secular country, but they could resist only 5 years to the pressures of Islamists, extreme Islamists. They became afterwards an Islamic government. And all Islamic governments started with moderate Islam, and many of them ended in radical Islam. When I visited Iran right after the Islamic Revolution, together with our foreign minister, we visited Khomeini. Khomeini introduced us, his colleagues, and he said, "This man will be my representative in Turkey." He said, "What does it mean?" "It means," he said, "that the job of this person will be to spread Iranian revolution in Turkey." Don't believe that they are all angels. Their aim is to spread their religion as a political tool to foreign countries. That's why the value of secularism in Turkey is absolutely important. In case we can export secularism and democracy to the region, it will be a tremendous success.